Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Massive pro-immigration protests are taking place around the country today, with estimates of up to 2 million people rallying in more than 120 cities, including Boston, Phoenix, and Washington, D.C. Organizers are calling it the National Day of Action for Immigrant Justice, or simply La Marcha. Demonstrators began mobilizing in December after the House of Representatives passed a tough new immigration bill that calls for a 700-mile fence along the U.S.-Mexican border and makes illegal immigration a felony. But the Senate recessed for 2 weeks on Friday after failing to pass a compromise bill that would also provide a guest worker program and set most undocumented immigrants on the path to citizenship. Well, for more on today's protests, we now go to Susan Phillips of NPR station WHYY in Philadelphia. Susan joins us from Love Park, where protesters are gathering for that city's midday march. And Susan, this is the second protest in Philly in a couple of months. What are you seeing today?
Robin, is a lot of American flag. 2 months ago on February 14th, Valentine's Day, Mexican immigrants had a work stoppage and rallied in downtown Philadelphia, and there were a lot of Mexican flags. And I think they got a lot of criticism for that. So today we're seeing a lot of American flags. We're also seeing a lot of other immigrants, folks from Africa, folks from other, parts of the world, El Salvador. I've spoken to people from Sierra Leone, Liberia, but it's a pretty big crowd here.
Yeah, we understand that many Asians as well have decided that they should not let this movement pass without them, but it has been largely an Hispanic movement. What is the Hispanic makeup of Philadelphia? I mean, how does it play out there?
You know, most of the Hispanics in Philadelphia are Puerto Rican, so the issue of undocumented immigration, doesn't apply to them. However, it has, I spoke to a couple politicians, councilman from Camden and an assemblywoman from New Jersey, who say that this really has mobilized the Latino community. Both of them are Puerto Rican, and they say that this really has helped unite the different Latino groups together and sort of rally for immigration reform that allows them, either guest worker status or, allows them some sort of path to legalization.
But that's interesting. You say the largest Hispanic population is Puerto Rican and therefore legal immigration, and that this has maybe brought about some unity, but I'm wondering if it's also caused some tensions within the Hispanic community there in Philadelphia.
I think it has. Some would say there's more. Some would say there is tension. Some would say there isn't tension. I think there definitely is some tension. I mean, the Mexican immigrants started arriving here about 7 years ago, so they really haven't been here that long. There's not a long tradition for Mexican immigrants here. Most Puerto Ricans live in North Philadelphia. The Mexicans live in South Philadelphia. And the Mexican community is growing and getting pretty empowered as well. I mean, they were sort of behind the movement on Valentine's Day to have a work stoppage.
Yeah. Well, Susan, we just want to get a chance to get a sense of what's going on around you. Is this a large protest? It certainly sounds it.
It is large. I'd have to say there's about 1,000 people here. Most of them are Mexican immigrants. They've come from all over the Delaware Valley, including South Jersey. And I spoke to folks earlier, a man who came from Hamilton, New Jersey. I spoke to folks from Korea, as well as Sierra Leone, Liberia. I spoke to folks from China. There's a big Fujian community here in Philadelphia. And they all seem to, be rallying around,
Well, we know in the past there have been also counter-protests. There was a big town meeting here in Boston with chants of USA, USA. Are there signs of counter-demonstrations there where you are?
Robin, I looked for them. I haven't found any. It's a pretty big crowd. I really haven't found any significant counter-protests.
And one last thought. Republican Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania has been at the center of the immigration debate. Has he said anything about whether or not this bill could pass? They all went home disappointed with the deadlock on Friday.
Yeah, Spencer said over the weekend that, you know, he feels cooler heads will prevail at the end of their two-week break. And then he feels like he's, you know, when they come back, that they will be able to work out a compromise. You know, Spencer's also said this is an issue that's very close to him because his own parents were immigrants.
That's WHYY Susan Phillips. She's speaking to us on her cell phone from Love Park in Philadelphia, where pro-immigration protesters are taking part in a nationwide demonstration today. Susan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, a new AP Ipsos survey shows almost 70% of Americans think the nation is headed in the wrong direction, an all-time low for the Bush presidency. One Republican pollster calls the new numbers scary and says his party has lost its advantage over Democrats on national security. The poll also gives Democrats a 49-33% edge over Republicans on which party should control Congress. A new book written by Democratic strategist Dave Mudcat Saunders and Steve Jarding sketches out a blueprint for how Democrats might do just that, but they say it will happen only if Democrats are willing to put away some of their anti-gun, pro-gay marriage bumper stickers. The book is called Foxes in the Hen House, How the Republicans Stole the South and the Heartland and What the Democrats Must Do to Run Them Out. The authors are veterans of a number of rural Democratic campaigns, including those of Senators Tom Daschle in South Dakota and Bob Kerry in Nebraska. And we're going to spend time with one today. Co-author Steve Jarding, who also teaches at Harvard, by the way, joins us in the studio. Welcome.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Boy, you say how the Republicans stole the South. Some would say the Democrats handed it to them. You don't have kind words for either party here.
No, go after both parties pretty much, in no small part because I think both parties deserve some of the blame. I mean, politics is really about those who would be served, not those who serve, and I think both parties miss that point. And you could argue that while Republicans, and we argue that they stole it, Democrats who are running a store pretty much kicked the front door open and said, we're going to go in back. And, and while they were in back, the Republicans stole everything out of the front of the store. What we mean by that, though, is that when you look at what's happened in rural America in the South, fully 160 million people live in rural America, 60 million in rural America, 101 million in the South. That when the Republicans came to power largely on a platform of divisive issues from race to religion that transformed itself into abortion and eventually gay rights, they did so, we believe, in a very cynical fashion. They did so looking at what Democrats had done under Franklin Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson, where they had programs that were actually building wealth in people, and those people were voting Democratic. What the Republican Party figured out, very cynically, was we can't win on economic issues, but if we can polarize the electorate on these very, very specific, difficult issues, we think we can win some races. Well, they did that. And the reason Democrats are to blame, and we go after the Democrats in the book, is they let them do it. And the best evidence, unfortunately, was John Kerry. At Dartmouth College in January of 2004, he was asked a question about campaigning in the South, and his response was, why would a Democrat go South? Hmm. Well, Senator, it's not just a political argument that, again, 102 million people live there, 31% of the population today, but it's a moral argument.
Right. Well, and it seems like as if you're saying that the Republicans cynically said, issues like faith, religion, moral values are important to people, so let's go after those. But as you point out, some would say Democrats didn't get that issues were and should be, many people say, important to people.
Democrats actually delude themselves by saying, well, the people in the South and in rural America, they were voting against their own economic self-interest, so they must be fools. Well, wait a minute, Democrats, you lost. So who's the fool? I mean, if something trumps an economic interest, Robin, it must be pretty powerful. If I can say to you, I'll vote for a different individual who's taking money out of my pocket, Democrats would be wise to find out what that issue
Why?
Is. And what that issue is, we believe, and we talk about it in the book, is we need to go at Republican strength. And Republican strength has been they defined the issues for America. They've defined family values. If you poll people today, Robin, and say, what's a family value? Most people will tell you it's abortion and gay rights. And I say, are you kidding me? Abortion and gay rights? They're important issues, don't get me wrong. But that's what's tearing the American family apart? I don't think so.
So you're saying, Steve Jarding, that they've been led to believe that, for instance, an issue like gay rights directly impacts them when, in fact, it doesn't
exactly.
have as much as other issues.
Exactly.
There's an example of this, and that is guns. Give us your thoughts on how Democrats sort of threw away this issue.
There is not a hunting gun in America that's ever been banned. There's not. But if you ask hunters, if you polled hunters, they'll say, well, Democrats want to take my guns. No, historically, they've never taken a hunting gun.
So you and your co-author are saying that Republicans are sort of selling this pitch that Democrats want to ban guns, but many Democrats do want to ban guns.
Sure, and that's part of our criticism of the National Democratic Party, is that the National Democratic Party has said, we want to register handguns. We want to ban certain guns. And I sit there and say, it ought to be localized. It ought to be either at the state or the local level should make those decisions. If the city of Boston or the city of New York wants to ban a gun, go ahead and do it. But I grew up in South Dakota. There's 600,000 people in the entire state. And people like me grew up hunting. We didn't hunt so much for the sport of it. You know why we hunted? We needed the meat. I mean, I grew up in a relatively poor family. We went out to fill the freezer. That's why we hunted.
This gets at the core of what you seem to be saying, is that Democrats, in sort of writing off a certain population, really don't understand the population.
That's right. And it goes to the culture, which is the underlying key to all this. If the culture in rural America is, but we've hunted for generations, in no small part, whether it's for sport or indeed to quote-unquote fill our freezer so we have meat in the winter, why should the National Democratic Party question that? Now, if the National Democratic Party wants to say in New York City we need to ban an assault weapon, I say, amen, could do that. But don't impose this national strategy on all parts of the country. We are a very diverse country. Our cultures are different. The cultures of rural America, the cultures of the South, a lot of people do hunt and fish. A lot of people do go to NASCAR races. A lot of people do listen to music that we may not listen to.
Boy, a lot of people. You actually detail how many people do. You have several pages showing in each state how many people fish, how many people hunt,
right,
how many people are wildlife watchers.
It's amazing.
And it is amazing. It's millions. In fact, half of the country.
In some form of outdoor wildlife watching or fishing, so the anglers population, the hunting population, if fully half of America engages in some of that activity at any point during the year, the monetary numbers are staggering. We go through the numbers on the guns. Half of every household in America has a gun in it. Now, you and I can say that bothers me, I suppose, but that's the truth. Every other person you're sitting next to at synagogue or church or wherever you're at, in your school, that's the reality.
Either that, or you might be in a church or a synagogue where no one hunts, and there's another part of the country where the entire church hunts,
right,
and they should be allowed.
Which is our point.
Saying.
Exactly, Robin. That's the point to me. If the part of the country that doesn't hunt wants to say, you know what, we just don't feel right about it, I understand that. I respect that. In fact, I probably would agree with that. But I can tell you, I live in Virginia now. There's a lot of hunters and outdoor sportsmen in Virginia. I grew up in South Dakota. It's wrong for those areas. Mm-hmm. Democrats need to quit being this elitist party. We become a bi-coastal party. We act as though the people in the middle don't matter. And I argue not only is it politically wrong, it is morally wrong. In a representative democracy, we don't have the luxury of saying, you know, your culture, Robin's a little different than mine, so I don't really want to represent you. Mm-hmm. You have as much right to representation as anybody in the country.
That's Steve Jarding. He's co-author of Foxes in the Henhouse, How the Republicans Stole the South and the Heartland, and What the Democrats Must Do to Run Them Out. Well, after we take a break, we'll hear more of what Steve thinks the Democrats can do to turn dissatisfaction with President Bush into Democratic victories in rural America. And also ask him, why isn't that a little cynical of the Democrats to maybe give up some of their core issues to get votes? And later, a retired major general reacts to reports that the Bush administration is considering nuclear attacks in Iran. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Co-author of the new book, Foxes in the Hen House. And Steve, I want to stay with one of the many topics that you write about. Your book argues that Republican policies are making it more difficult for hunters, fishers, and wildlife watchers to enjoy their outdoor activities. And you point to the loss of areas to enjoy these activities. And it's reminding us that recently outgoing Secretary of the Interior Gail Norton said that there are more wetlands now than when President Bush took office. And when pressed, it was revealed she was counting golf course water hazards, among other things, not exactly hotbeds for hunters, and yet Republicans, as you say, get the hunters' votes. You say that Democrats have to understand why voters would vote for candidates who might actually hurt their cause. And it's in part because Republicans have convinced people that Democrats want to take their guns. Tell us more about that.
If an individual is sitting out there saying, here's my life, here's what matters to me in my life. I go to a NASCAR race at a weekend, or, you know, I work hard and my wages are being cut and my mm-hmm. benefits are being cut. But at least my sanctuary is I go hunting in the weekend. I walk into the mountains and I go hunting, and maybe I need the food or whatever. But that's my sanctuary. That cultural act is so powerful to that individual that in this case, the Republican Party says Democrats are going to stop you from doing that, I say, my God, it's the only sanctuary I've got. Don't take that one. Mm-hmm. Whereas if the Democrats would change the scope of the debate, and we talk about it in that chapter where we say, wait a minute, Democrats, every hunter that I know, an outdoors enthusiast and angler that I know, knows that the greatest threat to their outdoor activity is habitat destruction, it's lack of conservation preservation. But Democrats don't argue that debate, Robin. They're not sitting there saying, wait a minute, guys, first of all, we're going to come talk to you. We're not going to write you off, as the National Democrats did in 2004. But when we talk to you, we're not going to concede this issue. The fact of the matter is Republican policies that are – and we've got a ton of documentation on what they're doing to the environment, what they're doing to conservation preservation habitat. That's what's killing hunters and fishers and outdoor activities. It has nothing to do with Democrats banning a gun.
You've got a three-point proposal here. You've mentioned that regional areas, local areas, should decide whether or not
right.
there should be hunting or guns. The second is that Democrats should give blessings to candidates from these areas to do what you think is right for your area.
Absolutely.
The third, that there should be a pro-hunting and pro-gun agenda?
Yes.
Meaning what?
Well, again, if I'll give you an easy example. If in America the biggest problem for hunters is that there's no place to hunt, why don't we consider opening national parks up to hunting as a Democrat?
Ooh, but what's that going to do to the core of the Democratic Party that says, no, we want to hike there?
And you'll have plenty of opportunity. Hunting season in America, almost any hunting season, whether it's turkey or deer, tends to be for a couple-week period. It's not like you're opening the national forest for – and by the way, it's just one proposal. You could do a whole lot of things. But the point is Democrats take an agenda that says, no, we're willing to open more land to hunt. That's one. Two – the government could sit back and say, in places like South Dakota, places where land is relatively inexpensive yet, and we're going to set aside more areas. The government's going to buy areas that become hunting preserves. So we don't have to go into the national forest, but we're going to create opportunities for you to enjoy outdoor activities. Instead, the contrast, look at what George W. Bush is doing to the National Forest Service. We're woefully underfunded in the National Forest to the point that they're starting to consider selling off national forest land. Mm-hmm. Any hiker in America knows you sell off that land, it's going to get developed. I mean, that land isn't going to sit there in somebody's private hands paying taxes on it.
So this is a place where hikers, hunters can possibly meet.
It should be able to, absolutely. Which,
on conservation.
To us, that's the nub of the argument is right now you tend to have the NRA on one side and the environmental community on the other, and we say, if you guys combine the power that these two groups would have, because your mission is really the same. Environmentalists want to preserve the land. Well, what does a hunter want to do? They want to preserve the land. There's no movement out there to ban all guns in America. It's a scare tactic, which, by the way, these Republicans have used on defense. They've used it on race. They've used it on religious issues. I mean, you go right down the line, fear is a common denominator for this Republican Party.
Yeah, but I'm thinking, too, of when a Democratic candidate did try to match the Republicans on the hunting issue, and it's John Kerry out in the duck blind,
right.
And it just did not
well,
work.
You can't fake it, Robin. I mean, to go out in Ohio and dress up in a camouflage hunting outfit that still had the creases in it, to go goose hunting one time and then not carry the goose back, which is against federal law, by the way. You have to carry your own game. A lot of hunters saw that and saw it for what it was. It looked like a publicity stunt. If John Kerry, by contrast, however, Robin, from day one had been saying, wait a minute, I understand the biggest problem to outdoors enthusiasts in America. It's look at what we're doing to your land and water. Here's my program to take care of it. We're going to create more preserves. We're going to make sure that wetlands are preserved, and here's how we're going to do it. We're going to do whatever it is, a variety of programmatic issues. And by the way, I do hunt and I'm going hunting. And, you know, instead of just 6 weeks out, you go one time and then you violate the law on top of it. You know, because people aren't stupid. Either you stand for something, you don't. By contrast, by the way, when I ran Mark Warner's campaign in Virginia, we had a very aggressive sportsman committee, very aggressive NASCAR. We sponsored a NASCAR. We did a bluegrass song. And we stood up and said, let's be honest. Mark Warner doesn't hunt. He doesn't fish. He doesn't go to NASCAR races. And he doesn't attend bluegrass concerts. But you know what? We do understand that those cultural entities are such an important part of Virginia's culture that we're going to embrace it. Not unlike we embrace high tech in Northern Virginia or the military in Hampton Roads, you're going to have someone who represents you. We're not going to belittle you.
Steve Jarding, he now teaches at Harvard and is co-author of the book Foxes in the Hen House, How the Republicans Stole the South and the Heartland and What the Democrats Must Do to Run Them Out. Do you still hunt?
Yeah, actually, I took my boys. I have twin boys that are 14. I took them pheasant hunting for the first time in South Dakota this last fall. And I will tell you, there was very little place to hunt. If I didn't have friends there, we'd have had trouble.
You talk about turning the debate over hunting from a debate over guns into a debate over the environment and sort of turning hunters into in the environmentalists that they really are.
They really are.
And I guess, did I read right that that's why you are a Democrat?
Yes. One of the reasons I'm a Democrat is because I hunt. Because I fish. And when we lose our habitat, when our streams are destroyed, when our air, land quality, when all that's gone, it's not because Democrats did it. Democrats are far better conservationists than Republicans are. So one of the reasons I'm Democrat, without equivocation, is that I hunt and fish.
Well, I'm sure you got a lot of ears to perk up just then with the sentence, the reason I'm a Democrat is because I hunt.
Yeah.
Steve Jarding, thanks so much.
You're welcome. I appreciate it.
Think about. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to go to a small town in Iowa to hear how immigration is affecting that community, from the economy to schools to politics. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR. Minds around the world today are screaming U.S. plans to nuke Iran and U.S. secretly plans airstrike in Iran, all in response to a story in this week's New Yorker magazine that claims that U.S. military planners are seriously considering using a tactical nuclear weapon to take out Iran's nuclear facilities. Against that backdrop, President Bush spoke with foreign policy students at Johns Hopkins University today. He was asked what advice he would give future diplomats considering the use of force.
My first advice is never use force until you've exhausted all diplomacy. My second advice is if you ever put anybody in harm's way, make sure they have got all the support of the government. My third advice is don't make decisions on polls.
And without referring to Seymour Hersh's New Yorker article directly, the president dismissed as wild speculation the story Hersh writes, claiming the U.S. is considering nuclear attacks and massive airstrikes against Iran. Well, joining us on the line with his perspective is retired Major General Bob Scales, a 30-year veteran of the Army, author and former commandant of the U.S. Army War College. He's president of Colgin Incorporated, a consulting firm specializing in war gaming and strategic leadership. Welcome back, General Scales.
Hi, Robin.
Well, give us your overarching reaction to the most provocative thought to many in Hersh's article, this reference to nuclear weapons.
Well, first of all, I have some personal baggage with Mr. Hersh. Back in the year 2000, when I was commandant of the Army War College, he was in the process of writing a scandalous and contrived article attempting to take on, at that time, General Barry McCaffrey. And he tried to use me as a sort of a foil for that, which I avoided. But so I don't regard him very highly as a journalist. Now, having said that, it's as I guess all of our listeners know, the military does continually do contingency planning. But it is basically contingency planning. It's not necessarily a plan that's going to lead to action. And the point about the use of tactical nuclear weapons is way beyond the pale. I mean, I just can't imagine any scenario in the future that dealt with Iran that would even begin to contemplate such use. I think that whole idea is totally ridiculous.
Well, that's what the White House is saying. But I have to say that Seymour Hersh, as you well know, has also been right on many occasions. And so, you know, let's just go with what he has written and just examine it from your perspective, because you have talked to us about possibilities in Iran. And the last time we spoke, you said airstrikes would be so tough because Iran is so mountainous. I mean, given that, doesn't it seem as if nuclear strikes would not be effective?
Well, the first part, this is a, you know, there's an old saying in military circles about the relative assailability of a strategic objective, and from a military perspective, Iran is about as militarily unassailable as any country on the planet, particularly from from through the use of airstrikes, whether the airstrikes use conventional or other types of weapons, given the size of the country, the vastness of the country, the secretiveness of the regime, the years that they've had to both deceive and to hide and to harden and to dig in and disperse their nuclear weapons building capacities, it is an extraordinarily difficult mission to even reduce Iran's nuclear weapons-making capability using air power alone.
And by the way, how many facilities are there? How many targets would have to be taken out?
That's a wonderful question, Robin. And the fact is, nobody knows. And when I say nobody, I mean nobody. I would be very skeptical if even the most informed planner in the Pentagon has even a remotest idea about the exact locations of their nuclear weapons making facilities. Now, remember, Robin, it's not just making of nuclear weapons; it's delivery systems, command and control, maintenance, manufacturing, repair. I could go on and on. This is a massive endeavor by the Iranians to build a nuclear program, and it would take an extraordinary effort to affect that to any great degree, and in my professional judgment, it really wouldn't do a whole lot of good.
So if Seymour Hersh is right that this is being war-gamed and considered by the military, your response would be it's a foolish endeavor.
Well, I wouldn't say it's a foolish endeavor. I say an extraordinarily difficult endeavor.
Okay.
And remember, the U.S. military, like all militaries, war games, or at least prepares contingency plans against any number of potential threats. It's interesting to note that in the 1920s and 30s, the United States built contingency plans against Great Britain and France and Germany and Japan. So this is just part of the military process, and we're taught literally at the strategic level of war, we're taught that nations to secure themselves are always coming up with contingency plans that may or may not be likely. In fact, most of them are unlikely.
Well, at the last time we spoke, you also told us that you thought that the one plan of attack that was feasible in Iran was to have small operating special
That's
ops
right.
groups on the ground with lightweight vehicles that perhaps aren't even, don't even exist yet. That brings to mind another detail in Seymour Hersh's article. He says there are already combat troops on the ground in Iran making targets, handing out money to ethnic tribes, that it's part of a move to have combat troops do what the CIA once did. Your thoughts?
I have no idea about that. Again, I am very, very. I don't have much trust in some of the details that Mr. Hersh puts in his articles. I think many of his facts are terribly improbable. Although his general thesis about the United States doing contingency planning, I think, clearly is spot on. But in terms of the technical details that he's come up with in this article, which I just read last night, I think much of it is really in the realm of fantasy.
Well, apparently an intelligence official told Hersh that this is part of a new buzzword in the military, force protection. In other words, have combat troops on the ground, because Donald Rumsfeld views this as the role of the military, intelligence gathering, instead of the role of the CIA. And in that way also, it end runs any kind of permission from Congress if it's military troops and not the CIA.
Well, of course, that's a ridiculous statement. I can't imagine anything like this being done without congressional oversight, particularly by the intelligence committees. And I'm fairly familiar with this type of operation from the first from the second Gulf War. You may recall that I wrote the history of that war, and there were special operating forces on the ground in Iraq, for instance, prior to the invasion in 2003. But all of that had been cleared with the intelligence committees, and even those of us who were not directly engaged in being part of the information chain were aware of this. So, first of all, it's just inconceivable that this thing would be that deeply buried inside our covert operations portfolio, not to be visible to Congress.
Retired Major General Bob Scales, president of Colton Incorporated, a consulting firm. Well, we'll check back in with you in several months and see what we find.
Oh, thank you, Robin.
General Scales, thanks as always. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, one of the effects of the current standoff between the U.S. and Iran is being felt right now at the gas pump. Oil prices are on the rise again, and experts warn there are no signs that they're headed anywhere but up. Prices are now nearing $70 a barrel, a level they reached in the fall after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita ravaged oil and gas facilities in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, more than 6 months after those hurricanes, more than 20% of oil output in the U.S. is still shut down, and the resulting shortfall, as well as unease about Iran and Venezuela, is causing many to predict that oil may go above $80 a barrel, and this is before the summer driving season begins. Well, joining us with more is economist Peter Butelli's president of the Cameron Hanover Energy Risk Management Firm in New Canaan, Connecticut. Peter, welcome as always.
Thank you.
And let's put this in terms people can understand. We remember the $3 a gallon gas when it hit 70. Boy, what might gas cost if it goes up to $80 a barrel?
Well, if it were to go to $80, then we would be paying probably 3.25, possibly 3.5. I don't know that we're going to be seeing numbers as high as $3.50 a gallon for gas. But we do have a lot of political uncertainty, and one of the things that is pushing prices higher today is the threat or the potential threat that the U.S. may go and attack nuclear enrichment facilities in Iran, and the stated intent of Iran to retaliate against others for anything the U.S. would do. And it could become a can of worms that once open could not be closed. Yeah.
This is in part because of the report by Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker that we just spoke of that, the U.S. is considering nuclear strikes against Iran. Of course, Washington says that's not true, just part of the whole war games. But, what else is there? We also mentioned that the output in the U.S. is still shut down. Is another factor the fact that we just don't have the ability to get enough crude oil, into gasoline?
Well, it is, but at this time of year, that becomes glaringly obvious because we take down units after the winter to go from a maximum heating oil slate to a maximum gasoline slate. We do it every spring, and as a result, this is the 21st out of the last 22 years, 21 out of 22 years, that gasoline prices have advanced from early March through April and presumably into middle of May. Everybody asks, well, shouldn't we change when we take down the units? The simple fact is we have to do it now because the demand starts to pick up dramatically after the end of the second quarter.
To transition from the winter fuel to the summer fuel.
True. Right. We also see after July 4th, when we have all the kids on vacation from school, we see a huge increment in driving from the 16 to 25-year-old crowd. July and August are also the two biggest months of the year for Americans to take vacations. These factors also add to the interest in gasoline.
Well, so, Peter Butelli, is there anything that can be done to relieve the pressure? OPEC boosting production, maybe bringing new refinery sources online? That probably can't be done quickly.
Unfortunately, there is no quick solution. There are solutions that are going to take years to accomplish that people are working on. And ultimately, we will break this cycle. But at this point, I'm afraid we're just going to have to fasten our seatbelts and hold on here. Prices will be higher by Memorial Day. We may get a little bit of a drop in June, which we typically do. But then we have to be careful because from Independence Day to Columbus Day, we have a very strong record of prices traditionally moving higher. Mm.
Peter, beyond the cost to run your car, just briefly, what other impact might we have from this higher oil prices?
Well, oil affects everything, of course. You need energy to plant crops, to harvest them, to transport them, to refrigerate them. You need energy to produce almost everything that we manufacture. Those ubiquitous screens that are on everybody's desks now, the kids who are emailing each other and IMing each other all day long, that's powered by energy. So it's pretty hard for us to get away from it, particularly in this modern society. Without energy, pretty much everything just kind of shuts down.
Peter Butelli is president of Cameron Hanover, an energy risk management firm, talking about forecasts of possibly crude oil reaching $80 a barrel. Peter, thanks very much.
Alrighty, have a great day.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Mm-hmm.
Meryl Streep said that if she never won another award, she would go to her grave happy. Well, now she will go, God willing, not for a long time, happier. After 2 Academy Awards and 13 nominations, Streep was honored last week with the 3rd annual Coolidge Award, named for a recently renovated and beloved independent theater here in Brookline, Massachusetts.
And then from the left, of course, Ms. Meryl Streep.
It's actually been a month-long celebration that included a screening of the upcoming film A Prairie Home Companion and panel discussions of Meryl's more than 30-year career. At one such discussion, Meryl Streep joined her colleagues from the 2002 film adaptation, screenwriter Charlie Kaufman, actor Chris Cooper, author Susan Orlean, who wrote The Orchid Thief, the book the film was based on, and also got her good friend Meryl to come to Boston in the first place. Meryl Streep played Susan Orlean in the film, a reporter who followed a man obsessed with orchids.
I wanted to want something as much as people wanted these plants. But it isn't part of my constitution. I suppose I do have one unembarrassed passion. I want to know what it feels like to care about something passionate.
An adoring audience showed up to hear the adaptation panel. We wanted to bring you some moments featuring the warmth and humor of the woman of the hour, Meryl Streep. Longtime New York Times critic Janet Maslin was moderator. She asked Streep why she was suspicious when she first saw the script.
It was such a great part, and I really wanted to play it, but I was very suspicious about why you wanted me to play it.
What ulterior motives?
It's not.
Why could he have had in mind?
Well, because Susan is smart and younger than I am and glamorous and younger than I am. And I just generally don't get offered, you know, at 50, whatever I was, parts for 38-year-old women, so I was very suspicious about why they wanted me in this movie, because it was a sexy part, and so I was really eager to play it, but I also thought, why do they want me? Are they going to make fun of me in this? And it's really true, and so I flew to California and met Charlie for the first time and Spike, and because I thought, I wanted to know if you were going to make fun of me in this movie. And they both swore up and down they weren't. And we embarked on it. Having said that, it was like a great part.
Didn't one of your kids urge you to do this?
Oh, my kids, yes, of course. They recognized hipness, coolness right away. And they said, you know, Charlie Kaufman is the bomb. Spike Jones, how can you not? And I said, I know, but I don't know why.
One of the things that you do that's very difficult to show, and it's more and more necessary and now that we all are on computers, is to type in an interesting way or to write in an interesting way. And I just wonder, I don't know how you made yourself look like a New Yorker writer, but you really did. You seem to be writing somehow when you were.
That's good because I can't even type. I mean,
and you didn't watch Susan. You didn't. You just sort of picked.
No, it's funny. I didn't watch Susan because I didn't want to be distracted by the truth. I had to fake a lot of it. I just. My mother told me, if you learn to type, then you'll have to type.
The panel also took questions from the audience, one of whom asked if Meryl Streep thought training was a big part of her success.
I believe in training, but I'm telling the truth when I say I don't understand the acting process and how you teach that. But having said that, everything else around acting, I think, is really important. So, the things that really I count on in my own training and I use all the time are things like my dance teacher, Carmen de Lavalad, who taught me where the center of my body is and how to make that space relax and also be very strong, hold me up, and to give me stamina. And the people that taught me to speak properly and not like I'm from New Jersey all the time. And the people who taught me, you know, to read sonnets. And my and I'm a believer in really good liberal arts education, because if you know a little bit of everything, baby, you know a lot. You know? And except math, I really feel you don't need it.
Another audience member asked if playing her adaptation character in the film An Adulteress, Drug Addict, and Murderer was a career risk.
No, except in reference to the first, my first issue in terms of, you know, because having become Meryl Streep, I have to, you know, protect and preserve the little thing that sits under that bell jar, which is actually me. And so I don't know. I don't think I really had anything to lose. My God. I'm not clear on the question. Is it that there's a jeopardy in making experimental things? No. I think that nobody knows the trope. Nobody knows what works. And Hollywood, all they want to know is a formula, and they can't really figure it out. As soon as they have a formula, it tanks, and something big with a big star goes down the tubes, and they can't figure out why.
And another fan got a big laugh after presenting Meryl Streep with a blueberry skull.
You've achieved this mythic status as the Meryl Streep and all of these things. My question is, who or what keeps you grounded? Who kind of says, oh, Meryl, you're not that great? Who?
At first, I liked you. Then, I'm, you know, married. For a really long time. And that person who is not here today, but... he's pretty important in that process that you mentioned. I also have four children who really are not impressed. And and a large extended family who also have various issues with me. So. This is all really nice, but, you know, tomorrow I go back to that, so...
Actress Meryl Streep, winner of this year's Coolidge Award, celebrating independent theaters. Recorded last week at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline, Massachusetts. In yet another side of Ms. Streep, we'll leave you with her singing Goodbye to My Mama with Lily Tomlin from the soundtrack of the upcoming film A Prairie Home Companion.
Goodbye to my mama, my uncles and aunts. One after another, they went to lie down. In the green pastures beside the still waters, and made no sound. Their arms.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
No longer I hear. They're in Jesus' arms, and he's talking to them. In the rapturous new...
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and...